not in favor of type classes. And I was, if that's true, I was curious why.
Well, it's very true, and not in favor is a very polite way to put it. Out of character for me too. The thing about type classes is they change. There's a tie between the type system and the semantics of the runtime behavior. And this is something that I'm against because, you know, I've been advocating this idea of pluggable type systems, where essentially you view the type system as a static analysis and you can pick and choose. It's not something that's wired into the language. And the key to making that work is that none of these analyses actually change what the language does, which is very different from what type systems that are defined for a language typically do, where they, in almost all cases, except, say, type lambda calculus, where it's done the right way, usually it changes how the language behaves. And type classes is a case in point. So I have this religious point that the type system should not impact the evaluation rules.
Okay, so let me ask you about a concrete case, right? Divide by zero, well-known, not defined, right?
Right.
If it's not type classes, there are other kinds of constraint systems, but how should something like the fact that divide is not defined over zero be captured?
Okay, divide by zero is, in fact, something that gives you a runtime error if you execute it, right?
Not on our system.
I'm tempted to say there's something wrong with your system, but I just don't know enough about it to say that, right? But I'd say that you separate the issue that, you know, how do you actually divide by zero is something that most type systems won't tell you about, right? Unless you get into dependent types and all this fancy stuff, and that stuff kind of makes me very, very uncomfortable, right? I have a low tolerance for complexity. But if you want to handle that, it's typically a runtime problem, and your runtime should ban it anyway. What is it going to do? Give you nonsense? It should be an error of some sort. And whether you type check and mark something one way or other should not change how that evaluates. Evaluation rules are independent of that.
So I said that our system doesn't throw an exception. Of course it does. Yeah. You have to check this. What I should have said was, we want to be able to check this at compile time because it's important to us to know statically that no exceptions are thrown. So how do you get there?
I think the us is really the important qualifier in your statement, which is you guys have completely disjoint goal sets. Jonathan's goal set in his work is these highly critical systems where it's not just that he can't tolerate an inconsistency, which is the widespread goal, but he can't tolerate a stoppage. He can't tolerate the system not being able to make progress or having an unexpected exception. That's very rare. That's well outside of the engineering of almost all uses of computers and programming languages. It's just, you know, you test for rare. I mean, for most systems, you test for rarity of the exceptional conditions, and you try to get some kind of static confidence in the integrity conditions, in the lack of inconsistency. And for some applications, the one you're concerned about, that's not good enough. And that makes all of the difference in the world with regard to the questions you guys are arguing about.
There's a rumor that Toyota is actually becoming very concerned about this as well.
That kind of embedded system, no, embedded systems in real-time devices, safety-critical systems, absolutely are the kinds of systems for which the kind of high availability assurance you're going for is important.
Well, so
that's a very small niche in the overall computer world.
Okay, but so the question I meant to ask Gilad is, do you have an alternative way to get there in your model?
So I actually, at this point, don't understand the contradiction, because I'm fine with you type-checking your thing to death. I just don't want it to change what the language does. So you're concerned that you actually wrote a correct program. So, you know, you want to buy a Toyota and still live to tell the tale. And so that's a fine thing, and you can type check it or verify it or do all the cleverness you want, and that's okay if it's worth, if you can afford the cost, and you know, in a very mission critical scenario, that's true. But none of that should change what your programming language actually does. It told you that you wrote it correctly, or it gives you as you analyze it statically, it tells you this is incorrect. Once you've got it correctly, it'll do the same thing as if you had actually, by divine insight, written that same code without type checking. You're just right by, which you probably are.
Yeah. By the way, since this is being recorded for a rather large audience, I should say a word to defend Toyota.
The evidence
is in on this. The evidence against Toyota is very weak to nil. The car equivalent of the flight recorders show that it was all the cases of unintended acceleration was actually drivers who hit the gas pedal rather than the brake.
That was reported and then contradicted.
Was it?
As I understand it.
Okay. But cool. We can leave Toyota out of the type class conversation. But yeah. Thanks for saying that because, you know, we don't have a problem with Toyota.
Okay.
Fair. Right on.
Yep. Yeah,
so, go ahead and get yourself a Camry, okay. Man. Yeah. Yeehaw. All right.
But I mean, continue with the. Yeah. So all I'm saying is the point of the pluggable types and the point of not having the types interfere with the runtime semantics has nothing to do with how much you check your code. It just means that when you have a type system, it isn't going to change what that code does.
Okay, so now I'm confused because it sounds like what you're arguing for is type erasure.
That is fine with me.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm not clear how the way that we're applying type classes in Bitsy changes the way the code runs.
I don't know how you're applying type classes in Bitsy, but type
classes have the same problem as type-based overloading, is that the type analysis is used as part of deciding what the program does, as part of disambiguating what paths are taken through the code.
Okay, now I understand the issue.
Okay.
Perfect.
Good. So I don't know if this helps you, but one of the things that our compiler does is compile down to a form in which all that stuff is gone that's still within the language. We actually deal with type classes essentially by template expanding them. So there is a stage after which they're gone.
Right. I don't think that helps me because you're programming to something where they're not gone.
Okay.
Right? But that was the root of that particular comment.
Okay. Mm. Thank you.
Excellent. This is what language designers do when somebody makes a comment during a talk. Amazing. So since you've been on now, what's going on? Here you are, Mark Miller from Google,
yes.
JavaScript, Caja, E.
Yep.
Right on. And we should probably talk a little bit about what that is. And
okay. Let's see. I've just given a
talk
about it.
Yeah, 5 minutes. Yeah, but now we're reaching like the tens of thousands of people. What are you doing in 5 minutes, man?
Okay. Caja is a system for rewriting JavaScript into JavaScript with runtime safety checks inserted into it that enforces that the JavaScript stay within the safe subset.
Okay.
By sanitizing web content through Caja, you can then take that web content and use it where you would normally use sanitized content, but preserving the behavior of the scripts.
Okay.
I gave an example during my talk of a blog, the corkboard demo, mm-hmm. At caja-corkboard.appspot.com, where you can take HTML content that includes embedded scripts, and if it passes the sanitizer, the legitimate behavior of the scripts is preserved, but the potentially malicious behavior of the scripts is prevented. And that's the essence of what Caja, that's sort of the first lesson of what Caja is about. The next lesson of what Caja is about is it implements the object capability security model. So if the containing application wishes to do so, it can have an intimate interaction with the potentially malicious content.
Mm.
It can take two separate bits of potentially malicious content that might be mutually suspicious, put them in contact with each other. They can now interact with each other, try to cooperate with each other, without being vulnerable to each other, and without the containing page being vulnerable to them.
Interesting. So, I mean, if you have any questions, feel free to ask. But the first thing I would ask, based on this, how is this implemented? It's implemented as a...
server-side translation.
Okay. So it requires a connection to the internet.
And of course,
you're not worried about insecurity, I would assume, in JavaScript if you're not connected to the internet.
The translation runs on the server.
Sure.
So for the code to come to be translated, at that time you have to have a connection to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, when code is coming to run on your browser, it has come from a server. Once it's on your browser, there's now the new web standards enable disconnected operation based on web workers and local storage and all that. If the code that has been downloaded has already been translated through Caja, it continues to maintain its safety properties even under disconnected operation. Mm. So you don't have to stay connected in order to have the safety properties.
So who's using Caja and what kinds of things are they doing?
Okay, so Caja has been deployed at scale for over a year by Yahoo. It's helping to protect the Yahoo homepage. Mm. It's deployed on several Google properties. It's available on several Google properties, including iGoogle and Orkut. And it's available on Shindig, and there's more integrations to come.
Interesting.
Excellent.
Very cool. Well, hey, thank you for that brief, excellent description. Now I'll move on to you. You've already been a part. We haven't even introduced you yet. Bitsy, people know that. Tell us who you are.
So I'm Jonathan Shapiro, and my company is a company called the Aeros Group, which is up in the Redmond area. Mm-hmm. We've already sort of given away part of the punchline, which is that the company works on high-confidence systems, and that's one of the reasons that we're concerned with Bitsy. But there's actually another reason. If I'm doing an application today, I basically have sort of two choices. I can write my code in C, in which case I get sort of no protection from a large class of mistakes. Or I can write it in a safe language, which could be Java or C Sharp, or it could be ML or OCaml on the more academic side. And I pay a significant performance penalty for doing that. You know, if you ask people on the street, they'll say, performance penalty for running code under CLR is factor 3 to 10. Now, it depends on the code, it depends on how long it runs, it depends on a lot of factors, but people have this impression whether
sure.
it's correct or not.
Okay.
Some of that impression is legitimate, because one of the ways that these languages become safe is they give up low-level expressiveness. So our goal for Bitsy is to get to the C level of control over data structures and representation, and still deliver the safety of these modern languages. Hmm. And it looks like we're getting there. The early benchmarks, at least, are showing about a 1.5% degradation to 3% in some cases, relative to C. And so that's actually kind of exciting. We're hoping to release a very early stage compiler sometime in the next couple of months. So it's kind of an exciting time.
Interesting. So. Very interesting. Now, the question I would ask, I mean, C is inherently an unsafe language. When .NET came out, we talked a lot about safe and unsafe languages, mm-hmm. right? Basically, an unsafe language.
Or managed and unmanaged, managed in the Microsoft term.
Or managed and native. The C++ okay. guys at Microsoft do not like it when we use the term native. When we use the term unmanaged, because we're like, wait a minute, unmanaged? No, we're native. So my question is simply this. I mean, part of being native in the power that you have with C, in the knives you're able to cut and slice yourself with, why not just develop more of like a managed runtime or virtual machine to accomplish your thing, but just instead of being a common language runtime or like the JVM or the CLR, you're in a specific embedded virtual machine to target your critical stuff, and then you're only working against your one language. So that's really, I don't know if I'm making any sense, but why are you trying to emulate C? That's my question to you.
Well, we're not trying to emulate C in the sense I think that you mean, but,
okay.
But let me tell you what the original motivating application was. It's broadened
Excellent.
Out since then. We have an operating system, and we have a kernel for that operating system, and it's a microkernel. It's about, last time I looked, it's about 25,000 lines of code. No, what am I saying? It's about 25,000 lines of code.
Hmm.
And it's a fairly high-performance system. It's, I think, one of the leading systems that's been benchmarked out there of the microkernel systems.
Nice.
It competes very favorably with the L4 kernel family. To get that level of performance, historically, you've had to go down to assembler or C. The problem with that is you can't analyze the result. The only way you get reliability out of those systems is, you hire the four or five world experts who can do that, you lock them in a room, you send in pizza, jolt, dancing girls, whatever they want, and you hope for the best out of their diligence. And it doesn't work at scale, it only works on small stuff. And the problem is that when the consequences become dire, when brakes fail, you need a little more confidence than that. And so we have a system whose ancestry goes back a long time. There are variants of the system that have been running uninterrupted in the field for 25 years or more. Which is, you know, what you can do when you get the right four people in a room. But, you know, doing it again is tough, and you want all the help you can get. So we wanted a language where we could analyze the kernel, where we could do robust static analysis. Some of the Microsoft users use SLAM or other tools for that, and SLAM is an amazing piece of work considering the languages that it has to work on.
Sure.
But one of the reasons that SLAM is less accurate than it could be is that those languages don't have strong type systems. And it means that the static analyzer can't do what's called sound analysis, which means not only may there be bugs at reports that aren't true, that are okay, but it can fail to report bugs. So in a language like Bitsy, you may get false accusals, things where it says, hey, there's a bug that's not actually a bug when you look at it, but it will not miss bugs. And that's okay. A fairly big job.
Excellent. So it's a statically typed
language. Safe language in the style
pointers.
And performance of C.
So yes, you have pointers and that kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm. Pointer arithmetic?
No pointer arithmetic at the moment, although with some of the stuff we're adding in the second version, we'll be able to do some of that.
Again. Excellent.
So... and without runtime bounce checking on it. So that's Perfect. Kind of interesting.
Excellent. So no blue screens using BitC and this 25-year running.
I know those blue screen authors are pretty talented.
Absolutely. Well, you just don't let people write in the kernel, man.
That's
yep.
Right. That's right.
That's what I vote for. Gilad, how are you doing?
Oh, Charles.
You were just, we have a long piece with you that people will see parts of.
Yeah, just tell
just
them when
you
to turn their channel 9 off so that
turn channel 9 off.
Safe.
So let's talk really briefly about what's the, you know, in 5 minutes, what's the latest addition to Newspeak?
Okay,
what's the status? What's
so we're doing a bunch of stuff engineering. Language-wise, we have this pattern matching extension that's experimental. What's unusual about it is that the pattern literals are objects. They really stand for invoking a library of, sending pattern a message like wildcard or literal or things like that. And just to make it attractive syntactically, that is the language extension that we actually have a literal syntax for these pattern objects. Mm-hmm. But what we get from that is higher order patterns, something you don't have in Haskell, but it's a lot like active patterns in F#. So we can abstract over patterns. We can write code that takes patterns as parameters and things like that. So that's Felix Geller's work, his master's thesis, that it'll probably evolve. We'll tweak it a bit, and we haven't really decided if we want to put it in or not.
Mm-hmm.
We've done a bunch of engineering. We're on the IDE. We're trying to get new source control framework so we can interact with basically your source control system of choice, either Mercurial or Git or whatever. Right now, we have a system that's rather too tightly tied to SVN.
Okay.
And we'd like to, ideally, we'll see how, again, this is a master's thesis of Matthias Klein, and if he gets where he's supposed to, then you'll actually be able to interoperate between these systems transparently from the Newspeak IDE. So that's another thing. Generally, we're looking perhaps to use the COG VM and have a JIT in there and have a big performance boost. Bunch of little things, but it's coming along, and there is also work on which relates to two of the gentlemen here on actors.
Right? Uh-huh.
We actually want to have concurrency. I'm not going to commit to anything, but there is a student working on that, and it's very similar in the model to the work that Mark did on E, which is then has transmuted into the quote real world of JavaScript. And very similar to Tom's work, which you should really talk about with Ambient Tom.
Absolutely. That was an incredible segue. How are you doing, Tom?
Hi.
So what's going on?
So I work at the Software Languages Lab at the University of Brussels. And so we are currently working on a language called AmbientDoc. AmbientDoc is a programming language, dynamic language, designed specifically for mobile ad hoc networks. So these are really computer networks of mobile phones. Mobile phones, they have Wi-Fi, they have Bluetooth, they can talk to each other peer-to-peer. And so we're developing a language with support abstractions to build those kinds of applications. In particular, we're dealing with the fact that in these kinds of networks, you have very little infrastructure. You don't have global connectivity. You can't always talk to a server to mediate interactions between peers. You need to do peer-to-peer programming. Because you do peer-to-peer programming and because these devices, mobile phones, are carried around by people. When people move about, these connections drop, the connections are restored, and people are moving back in each other's communication range. Mm. So there's all these distributed problems that you need to face. So Ambient Arc is a dynamic language. Mm. That it's a distributed programming language, concurrent programming language. It's built on the actor model. It's in particular built on communicating event loops, which is a model from Mark's e-programming language.
Nice.
And so the key abstraction of Ambient Arc is that remote object references don't fail when there are network failures. So network failures are not dealt with using exceptions. So objects are free to send messages to disconnected objects. Messages will be buffered. And then when the interpreter detects that the services have reconnected, then the messages will be delivered. So no messages are dropped to the floor when there are disconnections. And so programmers can use timeouts and leasing mechanisms to deal with failures. But so network disconnects, network exceptions are not modeled as programming language exceptions. So
interesting.
Right.
So now, since there's no servers, I mean, apparently, so the client, these are buffered on each client.
Right. That's right. So it's a peer-to-peer model of communication. Mm-hmm. So the other thing is that it's very hard if you don't have like global name servers to discover nearby services. So Ambient Arc comes with a built-in peer-to-peer service discovery protocol. It's very easy to write code to advertise objects in the local ad hoc network and to discover objects in the local ad hoc network. And so it's all built on top of actors. That means events. So it's an event-driven system.
Okay.
And so it provides strong guarantees with respect to avoiding traditional race conditions and avoiding traditional deadlock. So it's a purely event-driven system, and there are no blocking synchronization constructs. So everything is non-blocking message sends, non-blocking receive.
Very nice. And is this actually in production anywhere?
So we currently have an interpreter. It's open sourced. You can find it on the ambientarc.googlecode.com website. You can download it, and we currently have it deployed on the Android.
On Android?
Right. So you can run it on the Android phones.
Interesting. No, you're not going to make an iPhone app or
Windows
Phone 7, Lord forbid?
The ideas are definitely not tied in any way to Android or Java, but we're currently using sort of the JVM as a platform. It's very so Ambient Arc is a small scripting language for many of the standard libraries we fall back on Java. Uh-huh. But other than that, the language itself is fully self-contained.
Interesting. Now, as you mentioned, so you wrote it in Java?
Right.
Okay. And a question was asked, and there was actually a good question. You answered it, but I want to ask it for the people who are watching it. I mean, the idea behind your language is to be sort of 100% reliable, predictable. Right, you're using actors. You can guarantee that a message will get somewhere, and if it doesn't, you definitely will get information back, right?
Well,
that's not the case in Java.
No, you can post timeouts on messages
to
bound interaction. You can post timeouts on references, and so we have sort of leasing abstractions to deal with, you know, two services that disconnect and then, you know, don't reconnect after a while. Of course, you need to clean up resources. You
sure
deal with that. But so the idea is by default, your network abstractions are resilient. So
yes,
the default is to buffer messages rather than throw exceptions or drop messages.
Okay, so I really guess my real question was, when you pollute it, to use not in a harsh sense, with, say, you know, an object from the JVM, from a Java object.
Oh, right.
And what does that do to your resiliency, and how do you protect against
right
corruption?
So Ambient Arc is built as an interpreter on top of JVM. And so you can pass Ambient Arc objects to JVM objects. Ambient Arc and JVM objects can talk to each other, but JVM threads are not allowed to directly access Ambient Arc objects. Rather, if they want to get anything done from an Ambient Arc object, they need to send it a message, and the message is then scheduled like any other message in the message queue of the actor. So even when you're interoperating with JVM, which has a standard multi-threaded concurrency model, the multi-thread concurrency model can't violate the actor's model's guarantees.
Very, very cool. What do you think, sir?
I think it's very cool stuff. The idea occurs to me to steal his code and convert it to Newspeak.
I was thinking about that actually during the talk, but
yeah, well, great
for
minds
software
think
as a service.
Maybe that too. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, because you know,
the server is an actor. The peers are actors. You don't actually care if it's a server or not. You don't really care where it is to some extent. Mm. There's a lot of cool stuff. You should ask him about mirrors.
Mirrors.
Ask Tom about mirrors.
Right. So mirrors are a particular kind of reflection API. So AmbientArc, like NewSpeak, is a very reflective programming language. It means that objects can inspect other objects, can change various aspects of your code. So mirrors are a kind of reflection API where the data associated with the object is separated out into a separate mirror object. So you don't query objects directly for their reflective information. You rather have to ask a mirror on the object, and then you query the mirror for all of the properties, like what methods does this object have, what fields does this object have. Mm-hmm. And so mirrors will, first of all, allow you to reconcile reflection with security, in the sense that if no one hands you a reference to a mirror to an object, then you can't do any reflective operations on that object. So it sort of separates out the authority to reflect on an object into a separate object. Also, mirrors have benefits
that,
for...
That issue has actually been very hard in the .NET framework, right? The whole reflection feature in .NET has raised security issues that I think have been difficult to deal with. So it's a nice right. way to go at that problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, it raises security issues everywhere, because the classical way, what's done in .NET is not dissimilar to what was done in Java, which is a lobotomized version of what was done in Smalltalk and in CLOS and so forth. And it inherently, there is this problem, right? And that mirrors are an answer to that. At least we claim, and you know, we're validating. Tom is validating that.
I wasn't trying to pick on .NET. It's more this, you know, it's a Microsoft audience. .NET is sort of where their attention is, so it's relevant, I guess.
Besides, why not pick on .NET, Charles?
Everyone likes to pick.
Everybody likes to pick on .NET, and me more than most.
I know.
But by the way, just historically, the invention of mirrors was a paper by Gilad and Dave Unger.
Mm. Well, I won't take that credit. That is the documentation of mirrors for the academic community, actually putting it out there. The invention of mirrors is Dave Unger's work and Randy Smith way back himself.
Okay. I was wondering when Randy was going to get into this.
Yeah. It's really their work from, you know, the late 80s, and it then we used it in StrongTalk in a class-based system. And in production, it is in JDI, in the Java debugging interface. It's essentially a mirror-based interface.
And let me give a plug for ECMAScript 5 here. The latest JavaScript standard, ECMAScript 5, has in it a reflective API. It's not itself a mirror-based API, but it was designed primarily by Alan Werfsbrock from Microsoft, who's the Microsoft representative of the ECMAScript committee. And it was done very much with knowledge of mirrors, with the intention that it be a low-level API from which you can construct a mirror-based API. And even as a low-level API, it's consistent with all the security properties. Based on Tom's work on proxies for ECMAScript, which have been accepted for the next version of ECMAScript, I've done a little experiment where, combining Alan's reflective API with Tom's proxies, I was able to build a mirror system for JavaScript.
Cool.
Wow.
I might add.
That is really, really, really cool.
Yeah. A person, indeed, it's good that Alan's name came up here, because Alan did mirrors many years ago. He didn't even call them mirrors. I think it was called Firewall. There was this Smalltalk system that used mirrors for a different purpose. One of the issues you get in these reflective systems is, in fact, the ease in which you can shoot yourself in the foot. Which it's not as easy as you think.
I'm not sure
but
it's the foot exactly.
We won't go there. But wherever it is, it hurts. But it doesn't occur nearly as much as the static type fanatics think. But it can occur. And in Smalltalk systems,
guilty.
In Smalltalk systems, what can happen, because your whole IDE is reflective, which is a wonderful thing, where you can actually, you know, if you don't like what your IDE is doing, you can just go change it on the spot. But there is this problem that, say, you go off and change something important like object in the wrong way, and everything just can come to a halt. What's amazing is that hardly ever happens, but it can happen. Mm. And Alan's system back in, I guess, 95, 96, handled this, and mirrors will let you handle distributed programming of reflection. So because it's separated into a distinct object, it can really be a proxy, and you can then have one process debugging the other, or the whole IDE can be in one process, and you can modify it, the object in the other process and not destroy your IDE. And incidentally, this property of distribution is why it's used in JDI and Java, because the whole issue of out-of-process debugging, you can't do that with core Java reflection because the way it was designed.
Interesting.
And so all these things, you know, they tie together.
I bet. Now, I mean, you know, in some sense, it sounds, I wouldn't say too good to be true, but if you look at the way Reflection is implemented in .NET, I mean, there must be some thinking as to why mirrors weren't used, right? I mean, it can't be.
You think so?
Well, there has to be some trade-off. I mean, no?
I have no information about what the actual process of by which .NET was arrived at. I've never talked to any of the designers of .NET, so I can't speak to that at all.
Okay.
The Java Core Reflection API has very much the same philosophy as as what I understand to be what's going on in .NET. Correct me if that's different.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. And, you know, in general, you know, .NET was trying to be sort of, you know, JVM revisited. I think that's a, you know, fairly fair statement. And they got some things better, but overall they were just trying to look to the JVM for inspiration about what to do.
I'd comment on two things. One is what the trade-off is. There is a trade-off. There's always a trade-off. But I don't think that's, you know, I'm speculating a little bit, but historically there wasn't that much awareness of mirrors. The way .NET did it and the way JVM did it, it's all was fairly standard. It all followed what Smalltalk and CLOS did, except that with much restricted capabilities. And so it was the natural path to take. Now, if you actually do consider using mirrors, yes, there is a trade-off. The trade-off is because it's you're going through this indirection, it can get a little more awkward in the API, can be, you know, a little heavier weight to use, and I don't think there's even enough experience to say how good you can make that, but that is a trade-off that does exist. My sense is that probably because mirrors weren't well known back then, I don't know that anyone really considered that trade-off, but you'd have to ask Anders or somebody, right? They would know for a fact what happened there. But this is why I cajoled Dave Unger to write the paper that Mark referred to actually document this, and so this idea would be well-known, because it actually has been around since the late 80s.
Interesting. So interesting.
It's striking how small the community really is. You know, it's a very small group of closely connected people who've worked on these technologies, and it's interesting to watch how these things evolve.
Absolutely, and I have to say, you know, this conference that we were just at for 2 days, you know, kind of brought that home. I mean, it was a packed room of about, what, 50 people?
This room here?
Yeah. And much of what was talked about were extensions of what has been going on for the past 50 or 60 years, and a couple radical approaches, but... very interesting.
Well, here's something you may not know. It's kind of funny. Even among the four of us, they're close relationships. So Mark, I sat on your dissertation committee, Tom, didn't you?
That's right.
And I was Mark's dissertation advisor.
Yes, if
I think about it for a second, I will come up with a connection to Gilad, but I don't have it at the moment.
Yes, I refer to Shap as Tom's grandvisor.
Amazing.
So who said inbreeding was a bad thing?
Not at all. You know, you guys are doing brilliant work.
The other thing we should make sure to say, or maybe say again, because you may have already covered it, is we're here doing this just after the Emerging Languages Camp at OSCON.
Yep.
Each of us gave a talk at the Emerging Languages Camp, and as I understand it, all of those talks will be up on the website. So if people are interested in any of these technologies, they can come back and look.
Absolutely. We will be pointing to that.
Googling for these projects, or Binging, as the case may be, we'll find
whatever your favorite search engine is.
So thank you for
thank
taking
you,
the time.
Man. Okay. Really great to meet you. I'd like to talk more about what you're doing sometime. I think it's really great that you're on a committee with Alan Wurzbach and other people, and hopefully you guys will push the language in the direction it really needs to go.
The whole committee is very much on board with the direction of JavaScript. JavaScript is getting better very nicely. ECMAScript 5 is a tremendous improvement over where JavaScript used to be. And all the major browsers are currently implementing it. We really look forward to using ECMAScript 5.
Excellent.
Do you happen to know what the time frame is for browser deployment for ECMAScript 5? That you can say, of course.
First of all, I don't know. It's not a question of knowing something and not being able to say it. What I can say is if you go to wiki.ecmascript.org, that's the ECMAScript wiki, there's a link on the front page of that wiki to another page for tracking the progress of browser implementations. I put that little piece of the wiki together, the tracking progress. It links to somebody's matrix of all the different features and how they're filling in from red to green. It links to little search queries against all the different bug lists for the open source browser implementations. So you can do an ES5 search over the V8 bug list, an ES5 search over the Mozilla bug list, an ES5 search over the Safari bug list. And I check in on that actually quite regularly. Internet Explorer Preview 9 has a tremendous amount of ECMAScript 5 already implemented, and people are trying it out and finding interesting things.
Absolutely, and they're at Preview 3. The latest one we released.
Yeah, it's the latest one I'm referring to.
Yeah, right on, man.
Yeah.
Hey, great to meet you guys. Thanks for taking time. I know you're tired and.
Always a pleasure.
It's not even that. Mark and I and Andy Glue are doing a Birds of a Feather for Capability Systems in about half an hour, 25 minutes now. We've got to eat between now
and
then. But
hey,
but you should come because the stuff is closed off.
Well, I have a girlfriend in town with
me.
Yeah, you know what? My phone has been ringing in my pocket. It could be an interesting evening. No, it'll be fine.
Okay. Bring her.
Thank you.
Bring her.
Well, she doesn't come from this planet.
That's okay. We don't discriminate.
Right on.
Thank you, Charles.
It's great to see you again.
Thanks
a lot. Great work, man.
Thanks.
Great work. Take care, you guys.
Yeah, you too.